Good morning. Welcome back, everyone. I called the Human Services Committee to Finance and Policy to order. I hope everyone had a great break, and now we get back to work. With that, Chair Schumacher, did you want to move the approval of the minutes for March 26th?
So moved.
Chair Schumacher moves the approval minutes of March 26, 2026. Any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor, please say aye. Opposed? None. The minutes for March 26 are now approved. With that, members, we do have the governor's budget recommendation presentation. We will begin with direct care and treatment, the DCT proposal. I wanted to welcome Director Briones to proceed with the test. And please introduce yourself and proceed.
For the record, my name is Carrie Briones. I'm the Legislative Director for Direct Care and Treatment. And this morning, I will share with you our very short list of budget proposals on the governor's recommendations. So this year, we limited our priorities to really kind of focus on a couple items. But the good news is all of our items are budget neutral. I'll say that first because maybe that will be exciting for folks. But really, we looked at cleaning up some statutes related to DCT separation, allowing some secure facilities to plan for future security improvements, and then ensuring that some of the work related to priority missions, an initiative that's been pretty impactful thus far, is able to continue. Our first proposal is related to authority to accept gifts for patients. While DCT does have that authority in the chapter that was created when DCT became a standalone agency, there is a section in 15.43 that still refers to the DHS commissioner by rule prescribing procedures to accept gifts for the benefit of patients. Now that DCT is its own agency, these patients are under the purview of the DCT's executive board. So really what this is doing is just cleaning up statute to make sure our governance is accurately reflected in the statute and continues to support the authority that DCT already has in statute. Our second proposal is related to an exemption from security body scanner requirements. And for a little bit of background, in 2019, the legislature exempted correctional and detention facilities and their employees who operate security screening systems on humans from certain exemption and inspection requirements. These requirements were meant to ensure training for medical staff and the safe use of high-powered X-ray machines in medical settings. Security body scanners like those DCT may explore do not fall under this category. While DCT operates facilities with similar security and safety concerns as those covered by the statute, DCT is not qualified for these exemptions because its programs are considered secure treatment programs and other treatment programs operated by secure treatment facilities rather than correctional or detention facilities. And so a key component, of course, of having successful treatment is having a therapeutics atmosphere, which includes keeping our facilities safe. This proposal will allow DCT to explore operating security body scanners in its secure facilities in the future. The goal of this proposal is to increase safety and security by preventing contraband from entering these facilities. But this change will have other benefits, such as reducing the need for invasive and potentially traumatic visual body searches of clients and patients. It supports the dignity of the people that we serve. It also reflects broader conversations in behavioral health about balancing security needs of behavioral health care facilities with the rights and well-being of patients and clients, and aligns with best practices that emphasize both safety and respect. DCT did consult with the Minnesota Department of Health, the agency that oversees X-ray regulations, to develop the language for this proposal. And DCT at this time is not looking to purchase any scanning equipment, but if this passes, we'll begin a more formal planning phase to determine next steps. And our last item that we have on our budget, the proposal list this year, is to extend the DCT County Correctional Facility Support Pilot Program. And what this pilot program is it was established in 2024 and was the result of work of the Priority Admissions Task Force. This pilot was tasked with surveying county correctional facilities and their contracted medical providers on their capacity to provide injectable psychotropic medications including involuntary administration of medications and barriers to providing these services. It's also tasked with providing education and support to county correctional facilities and related stakeholders on protocols and best practices for pursuing civil commitment and court-ordered antipsychotic medications, and providing technical assistance to assure that Jarvis orders can be enforced effectively and safely while an individual remains incarcerated, including use of rapid building, de-escalation, and use of injectable medications. So the original appropriation was $2.3 million and is available until June 30th of this year. Due to the time needed to get the pilot staffed up and running, the full appropriation will not be spent by June 30th. The jail consultation services team has finished gathering baseline data and has begun to developing a necessary network of partners, but requests additional time to further current efforts, refine services, and scale up operations to reach more county jails. This work that has been ongoing has continued to gain momentum and increased from county jails. Extending the availability of the appropriation will continue efforts to support county correctional facilities in safely and effectively administering psychotropic medications, including involuntary and injectable treatments to incarcerated individuals with serious mental illness. In addition, these efforts will reduce delays in treatment, improve the safety of those individuals and staff who are working with them. And members, that is the extent of our budget proposals this year, and we are available for questions if you have any.
Thank you so much for the presentation. Members, you do have in your packet the language proposed for the supplemental budget recommendation for direct care treatment. Do we have anyone in the public who wants to testify on this? Seeing none, member discussions? Well, I think it was straightforward. No major changes, no budgetary issues that need to be considered other than the extension. So thank you so much for the presentation. We'll move now to the Human Services budget recommendations. Good morning, Director Bailey. I know as you are getting ready, please introduce yourself and proceed with the presentation.
Well, thank you, Chair Norr, members of the committee. I'm Elise Bailey, the Budget Director at the Department of Human Services, and today I am here presenting the governor's budget. And I promise I won't be as quick as direct care and treatment, unfortunately. All right, so shifting into what our budget is based on this year and the pillars that surround the items within the governor's budget, we have five main categories of proposals in our budget. One is really thinking about how we can transform the human services system to really meet the needs of Minnesotans in a better way. And I'll go over the specific proposals in that bucket. The second one is responding to federal action. A lot of these proposals mainly lie in the other jurisdiction, the health jurisdiction, but I am presenting on those today since this committee has been really interested in how the department plans to implement particularly the HR 1 provisions. We also have several proposals around strengthening program integrity and a few targeted investments, given that it's a budget year or a policy year, not a budget year. We don't have very many items in this camp, but we do have some key critical investments that we think that we need to make more quickly than waiting for a budget year. And then lastly, because the state budget still is looking at a structural deficit in the tails, our budget does include some additional items that will curb spending growth in areas where we're seeing growth over time that exceeds, you know, the growth in revenues that the state is projected to receive. This slide goes over, in summary, what our budget looks like this year. This is across the jurisdiction, so not broken out just for this committee, But we have around 35 proposals, and that includes a few proposals that actually land outside of the jurisdictions of both the Health and Human Services jurisdiction. So we have a few that cross into state government, state gov, and children and families. The totals across all of our proposals is about $240 million in savings in this biennium and $489 million in the tails. So jumping in, so transforming the human services system, why transform the system? Now is a time where we need to kind of take a step back and think about if we were to build our system today, how would we build it? We know that it is challenging for people to navigate the complexity over time of our program. You know, building upon, I like to talk about it as if we have a foundation of our house and over time we've built additions and additions and additions, and that's added complexity to the program to the extent where it's really challenging for people who need access to healthcare and human services to navigate the system. That has grown dramatically over time. And it makes it difficult also to administer the system, whether it be the state administering certain aspects of the human services system, or it be the local governments, the tribal nations, and the counties having to administer a system that is complex, has different rules added to it over time, whether it be from the federal government or the state legislature, making it really challenging for them to navigate administering the system. We also know that disinvestment and underinvestment in administrative dollars has led to challenges in supporting the core functions. You know, I presented in this committee a few times that our administrative budget at DHS is 2 to 3% of our entire budget. That is an amount that a nonprofit or other entity wouldn't be able to administer any of their programs if they had an administrative budget of 2 to 3%. This also is a challenge at the local governments. We hear counties talk about how it's really challenging for them to take on the tasks and to support that with local tax dollars when we are operating at a deficit in terms of having the administrative capacity to support the core functions of the program. We also have a hybrid fee-for-service and managed care system. So we have 8 managed care organizations. We also have fee-for-service within our MA program. And that has created a siloed approach to program integrity where each managed care organization is responsible for administering the program integrity aspects of the claims that they're paying for, and the state is responsible for administrating the program integrity aspects of the fee-for-service program. If we are doing 9 siloed approaches to program integrity, we aren't looking at the program as a holistic picture, and we have higher financial risk at the state when we operate it that way. Decentralization of roles has also resulted in different policies, procedures, processes, rules, and those depend on where you live and sometimes depend on who you're working with at each individual local entity or managed care organization. That really impacts what services you can access, the rates that are provided to providers, the network that you can access. And so what we're really looking at thinking about is how can we create one set of rules, one set of processes that every Minnesotan who relies on our programs can rely on. So going into our proposal on our budget book, which is published on our website this year since it's a policy year, this is on page 3. The total fiscal impact of this proposal is $16.5 million in this biennium and $54.6 million in the tails. We have five different components within this proposal. One, we are proposing to eliminate the use of managed care organizations in the Medicaid program. We're proposing to shift some of the financial eligibility functions to the state, and I'll go over what those specific items are. We are looking to help out with the backlogs in the Min Choices assessment process. We're also looking to reform waiver case management by phasing out the use of contracted case management and having clear roles and responsibilities identified for that service and rates that meet the local government's costs. And then lastly, we want to do a comprehensive study to develop recommendations in future years on what the correct delegation of roles should be between the county, tribal nations, and states, and the state in administering human services. So jumping into the first component of this proposal, again, I mentioned that we have 8 managed care organizations. That accounts for about 45% of total MA spending, or 80% of the basic care portion of our program. Through this mechanism, the state pays a monthly capitation payment to the MCOs, and then the MCOs pay the claims on the state's behalf. MCOs set their own rates, they set their own provider networks, they set their own prior authorization and billing requirements, and their program integrity processes. With that, the financial and program integrity risks fall on the state. The original intention of utilizing managed care in the MA program was really to actually mitigate financial risk, where we set a capitation payment and then they have to work within that payment. But what we're seeing over time is that the financial risk has actually fallen on the state. For example, in November, we had to increase managed care rates by an average of 16%. And we had no ability at the state or the legislature to set the rates, set the prior authorization requirements, set the network, that those are all tasks that the managed care organization is doing. With our proposal, we are proposing to transition this to an administrative service organization model, or an ASO model, starting January 1st, 2029. This ASO would be responsible for administering just the administrative functions related to healthcare claims. And then the state will maintain all of the policy decision making. So again, setting the network, setting the rates, setting the prior authorization requirements, setting what the program integrity requirements and processes will be for the entire program. What we're seeking to achieve is that all people across the state will have access to the same provider network, the same rules, the same processes. And we're seeking to eliminate complexity and access barriers there. We're also seeking to take back real policy decisions to the state and the legislature for overseeing the Medicaid program. With that, we can better influence spending and mitigate financial risk for the state budget. And we can better incorporate program integrity processes from a holistic perspective rather than in siloed approaches. The next part of this proposal is shifting some of our MA eligibility functions. So Minnesota is one of 10 states that has a state-supervised, county-administered human services system. And counties and some tribal nations are responsible for determining a person's eligibility for Medicaid. Some of the challenges that we've seen are, as I mentioned, the increased complexity in this. Some aspects of the Medicaid program have different eligibility rules. We also, of course, have aging systems where local governments have to do a lot of manual workarounds in order to do that eligibility process. We also see that local governments have large caseloads and, in many cases, unfunded federal mandates, such as with the HR 1 provisions. What we're seeking to do is, beginning July 1st, 2028, transitioning eligibility functions to the state through a two-phase process. Phase one would take on some of the manual eligibility functions and special programs eligibility processing that the counties and tribal nations currently do. And I'll go over what those are in a minute. And then phase two would be to work with counties and tribal nations on studying the whole financial eligibility process and recommend in a future year how any of those functions could transfer to the state. What we're seeking to do with this is to really ease the burden on the local governments in aspects of the eligibility process that are more manual in nature and require some manual workarounds. We're also looking to have a more seamless enrollee experience, removing the burden of providing the same documents in multiple places. One key aspect of this proposal is to have a central document storage place where we can receive the documents and communicate with our counties and tribal nations about those documents. We're also looking to co-create a long-term strategy with counties and tribes. One key aspect of this proposal is not just taking the entire thing on without working together with our county partners and our tribal nations on what would be the best delegation of duties here. The next part of this proposal is to help ease the MnChoices assessment backlog. So right now, counties, managed care organizations, and tribes are responsible for conducting assessments that determine a person's eligibility for long-term care or long-term services and supports through the MinChoices assessment. This is also known as the functional eligibility process. We do know today that delays often occur due to the backlogs and the really large caseloads that counties and tribal nations have, and constraints in current law on the time that they have to conduct those assessments. We do know that the average wait time that people are waiting for their initial assessment exceeds the timeline requirement in law, and that has grown over time. What this proposal does is not take that function from counties and tribal nations, but instead create a new team at DHS to help conduct assessments in areas where there are backlogs or areas where a person may be experiencing particular system barriers or don't have case management. We would also establish a work group to develop long-term solutions to the assessment process. So one key component of this proposal is to enable us to have better data where we can track where are the barriers, where do they exist now, and what are the reasons for them, to have a long-term strategy around helping people really get access to care when they need it. The outcomes we're seeking here is to support counties and tribal nations in these assessments and easing access to barriers for people seeking support, collecting comprehensive statewide information to process and identify future solutions, and again, co-create a long-term strategy with our partners at the counties and tribal nations. The next component of this proposal is to reform waiver case management. So currently, waiver case managers are responsible for developing a person's support plan and ensuring that the services meet the person's needs. We do know that right now there are high caseloads here as well at the counties and tribal nations, and there are unclear expectations, high turnover, low reimbursement that hasn't been changed in many years, and increases in acuity and complex conditions of the people that we're serving over time. Many counties and MCOs utilize contracted case management, and that has also resulted in varying enrollee experience and inconsistent oversight and expectations. This is really a critical service to people who need long-term services and supports, and we need to make sure that there are clear roles and responsibilities and that the local governments get reimbursed for the criticalness of the service. So what we're looking to do here is to study the roles, responsibilities, and oversight requirements of what waiver case management should be, and to set a new rate methodology that aligns the actual costs that the local governments incur with the rates. The report for this would be submitted prior to the 2029 legislative session with the goal of having a new rate methodology and clear roles and responsibilities coming out of the 2029 legislative session. This proposal also phases out the use of contracted case management by July 1st, 2031. What we're trying to achieve here, of course, is consistent oversight and expectations at the end of the day, improve the experience for people receiving services. We also are seeking to have a rate that reimburses our local governments appropriately. And then lastly, and a very important part of this proposal, is to really have a comprehensive study on the global role of the state, county, and tribal nations in administering human services. This will be looking at all of the programs that DHS administers, so Medicaid, Minnesota Care, Behavioral Health, Housing, Economic Assistance, Licensing, and Oversight. This study also would include some DCYF functions, such as the licensing functions that they administer, the Fraud Prevention Investigation Program that they work on with local governments, the Economic Assistance Programs that they administer, Child Support, and CCAP. What we're seeking to do here is to assess the current state, so the status quo, on what the current roles and responsibilities are across all of these programs. We want to look at how other states administer human services, focusing on the roles of local governments versus state agencies. So we would be looking at the 9 other states that have a county-state administered system, as well as the other states that don't, And there's a lot of variability in those functions. So looking at what they do, how it works, does it work well, and taking in ideas that we could have here at Minnesota. We also want to look at the financing of human services, and this is a key component of this study, looking at what does it really cost to administer human services, both at the state level and the local level, and at the end of the day, have a recommendation on the ideal delegation of duties with the goals of having a transparent, accessible, accountable, equitable, and effective system for all parties. The recommendations would include financing strategies and would consider, you know, workforce challenges that we see, systems that are the underpinning of our programs, and if we were to change any delegation of roles, what the timing would be to ensure that people have continuity of care throughout that transition. Okay, moving on to the next category of proposals. So in terms of federal compliance with HR 1, we do know that HR 1, of course, will impact all areas of the state. We have a large proportion of the population across the state that receives their health care through Medicaid. We know that the changes in HR 1 will result in the loss of coverage for Minnesotans. We also know that it will also increase uncompensated care for providers and hospitals that rely on this funding stream significantly across the state. We also know that, you know, speaking to the previous proposal on transforming human services, we know that HR 1 will further increase complexity for the administration of MA as well as in accessing MA. And we also know that it will reduce federal funding to states. So what our budget does is attempts to mitigate the impacts to Minnesotans and minimize burden on the local governments in terms of helping people access and determine eligibility for medical assistance. This next slide goes over the timelines in terms of the provisions that we are required to implement the HR 1 items. I came to this committee maybe a month ago and presented on it, and I just thought I would bring this up now because this is an important aspect of why our proposal is really important, that we have really intense timelines that we need to implement these provisions. So we have two proposals around HR 1. One is centered around the eligibility changes in HR 1, and the other is centered around the financing changes within the federal bill. In terms of eligibility, our proposal, effective January 1st, 2027, ensures that we can hit the requirement that the HR 1 bill had that requires some people receiving medical assistance to have six-month eligibility renewals. This applies to the adult expansion group who are not American Indian and Alaska Natives. And this proposal conforms state law with this requirement. It also provides navigator funding and administrative resources to implement. Another item in HR 1 that we need state law changes to implement is requiring enrollee address information. So effective January 1st, 2027, states must use data from managed care plans, the United States Postal Service, the National Change of Address Database, return mail, and other data sources to regularly update Medicaid enrollee addresses. This proposal conforms state law with this requirement, and it also provides us administrative funding to implement it. The largest component within our proposal is centered around work requirements. So effective January 1st, 2027, MA applicants and enrollees who are 21 to 64, who don't have kids, who are not pregnant and not seeking MA based on disability, also known as our expansion population, will be subject to the work requirements. This proposal conforms our state law with this requirements and provides funding to implement the provision, including utilizing an external vendor to assist our local governments and the administrative costs to the state to implement this provision. One key thing about this provision is we are requiring, in terms of the applicants needing to meet the work requirements, that they need to meet an exception or complete a qualifying activity in the month prior to application if they're a new applicant. If they're doing a renewal, they would need to meet the work requirement qualifying activity in one of the 6 months prior to renewal. So that's one key aspect of our proposal. The fiscal impact of the work requirements, the six-month renewals, and obtaining adverse information is $11 million in this biennium and $33.7 million in the TAILS. Our proposal also has a technical change centered around the changes for legal non-citizens. So HR 1 specifies that people who are age 21 or older who are not pregnant and are not lawful permanent residents, Cuban or Haitian entrants, or Compact of Free Association migrants, but have other lawful statuses, do not have access to Medicaid. Our proposal makes a technical change that is neutral related to that. Lastly, this proposal limits retroactive Medicaid coverage. So HR 1 specifies that the federal retroactivity period is 2 months for all populations except for the expansion group. Currently in our Minnesota state law, it is up to 3 months. So this proposal modifies state law to align with that retroactive period. The fiscal impact of this item is about $11 million in this biennium and $70 million in the TAILS related to the retroactive coverage piece. The second proposal is centered around the financing related response. So this implements cost sharing for enrollees who are adults without kids with incomes between 100 and 133% of federal poverty level. HR 1 requires states to have cost sharing up to, I think, around $35, and this implements what our cost sharing used to be prior to the 2023 session. It also strengthens Medicaid program oversight and support for county and tribal nations to increase our accuracy and audit preparedness. One item in HR 1 provides a requirement that if there's any instance where a state falls above the 3% error threshold, we would lose FFP. So this is a strategy we are deploying to assist our local governments to enable our accuracy and audit preparedness to mitigate the impact of that. This proposal also has a few budget neutral items, such as establishing a ceiling of $1 million for permissible home equity values for people determined eligible for long-term care, as well as a technical change related to the Minnesota care provider tax. Another item within our federal compliance section is investing $10 million into the Human Services Response Contingency Account. This was an account established by the 2024 legislature that enabled the Commissioner of Human Services to respond to immediate needs supporting the health, welfare, and safety of people of Minnesota and for which no other funding source is available. This is particularly needed due to the current federal action and federal funding uncertainty. This is on page 36 in the budget book. Moving on to program integrity. So what we know and what we've learned over the last year is that we need a comprehensive program integrity approach, not just in our Office of Inspector General area, but really strategies that are embedded into the life cycle of the Medicaid program. This will provide a dynamic method for integrating our learnings and changes over time into each strategy. So this includes having a better ability to vet providers on the front end. It includes having better and more robust program design to mitigate any potential for fraudulent activity. It also means having controls once a provider provided the service and they're billing us to pay the claims, having controls in place prior to the claims being paid. And then lastly, having post-payment review and post-payment actions to mitigate the impact of program integrity risk. So the first program integrity proposal is found on page 38. This proposal has a fiscal impact of about $168 million in savings in this biennium and $4 million in the TAILS. This proposal would implement a comprehensive systems approach to reduce fraudulent, wasteful, or abusive billing practices in our public health care programs. This proposal is really centered around having the strategies in the systems that operate our claims in order to mitigate potential fraudulent billing. So this would establish a comprehensive prepayment review of all fee-for-service claims. It would also then establish a comprehensive post-payment review of all claims. And then it would deploy predictive analytics and machine learning to continually inform prepayment review, post-payment review, our program integrity investigations, and the future benefit design so that we have more information at our fingertips in order to embed program integrity processes throughout our program. The next proposal is found on page 45. This proposal is about $24 million in this biennium and $47 million in the tails. This has several components within it. The first one is establishing a data-driven risk assessment process in our provider enrollment process. The risk assessment would evaluate a provider's organizational readiness, their financial stability, their compliance history, their business registration with the Secretary of State, and service necessity. So this would just enable us to have a more robust process in the enrollment process to enable us to ensure that the provider is in good standing and could and would be able to provide effective Medicaid services to our populations. The next proposal shortens the timeline providers must respond to revalidation and potential termination of enrollment from 120 days to 60 days. This item is required from our federal requirements that we're working on with CMS at the moment. The next proposal is centered around our MCOs. Yeah, again, 45% of our spending is paid through MCOs, and contractually, MCOs are required to do program integrity oversight and conduct procedures that effectively detect and prevent fraud, waste, and abuse. This proposal provides additional resources and requirements in state law that are needed to enhance that oversight over the contractual program integrity responsibilities of MCOs. This would require MCOs to conduct prepayment review of the claims that they are paying. It would provide funding at DHS to conduct post-payment reviews of the MCO claims. We would also require MCOs to do similar things that we're doing on the fee-for-service program, such as posting publicly on their websites the program integrity actions that they are taking. It would also require them to implement all the claims edits and policies that we require on fee-for-service claims. For example, if we have a billing limit on a fee-for-service claim, the MCOs would we would require the MCOs to have that same billing limit. This also adds additional staffing at DHS to enhance oversight over MCOs. Currently, in our Office of Inspector General, we have three FTEs that have oversight over the MCO program, which accounts for 45% of our spending. So the intention here is to just have a more robust program integrity approach to the claims paid through MCOs, as well as to have an approach that is the same that we have on the fee-for-service side. We're also looking to strengthen background studies requirements for high-risk providers. This is an item that also is required in terms of the work that we're doing with the federal government on our high-risk services. This would add authority to conduct background studies for the following four high-risk provider types: adult rehabilitative mental health services, or ARMS, peer recovery, adult assertive community treatment, or ACT, and recuperative care, and provide systems funding to implement those changes. This proposal also funds a comprehensive evaluation of DHS structure and processes. It would provide $500,000 in fiscal year 27 for phase two. Right now we have an RFP out right now for this study where we're looking to really have a external entity come in and look at how DHS is currently structured and to provide recommendations for how we should embed program integrity and have a better structure within the agency. This is the phase two where we are looking to have even more robust recommendations beyond what we're doing in this phase one. This proposal also clarifies communication methods for withholding and recovering funds. It would give us authority to use the biweekly remittance advice report to providers as notice for when we're seeking monetary recovery, utilizing our MMIS program when we're reprocessing claims. The next program integrity proposal is found on page 54. The fiscal impact is around $11 million in savings in this biennium and $282 million in the tails. This proposal also has several components within it, with the goal of improving the billing and oversight functions within the disability, older adult, and behavioral health services space. The first item in this proposal is expanding the use of electronic visit verification, or EVV. EVV documents service delivery, allowing us to analyze whether service delivery is aligned with the person's support plan and that the claims that are submitted are aligned with the services that are rendered. Right now, we have EVV on some services. This proposal expands EVV to ARMS, peer support, CRS, ACT, EIDBI, customized living, FRS, adult foster care, adult companion services, adult day homemaker, waiver transportation, NEMT, and CTSS. This proposal also adds or modifies billing limits. So we are seeking to have more expansive limits in the system to ensure that we're mitigating risk and instances of upcoding or overbilling the state for these services. And the list of services here, I would note that in the change page, we have a more robust table in terms of what we're proposing for these billing limits. We're also seeking to eliminate remote provision for provider-controlled settings. So adult day services, community residential services, day support services, family residential services, and integrated community supports. Remote provision was added during the pandemic, and at this point, these are provider-controlled settings where people are receiving direct care, and so we are seeking to eliminate the ability to have remote provision in those cases. This proposal also requires an electronic record of providers agreeing to the support plan for people. To do that, right now, providers do sign the agreements, but we don't have an electronic method for recording that. So this would provide a role-based access to MIN choices for providers. It would enable them to just see the support plan that relates to the support that they're providing the person, and they could sign that support plan within the system, which would establish an electronic record that they are agreeing to that level of support for that person. This proposal also increases the documentation requirements. So we're looking to require HCBS residential providers to maintain staffing documentation on an ongoing basis to reflect what actual staffing they're providing and the services they're providing. This would also provide DHS authority to collect that documentation directly from providers, in addition to the local lead agencies. Many DWRS rates are established using staffing hours determined by the lead agency and the service provider. So, for example, with CRS, you know, they put into our rate framework how many one-to-one hours, how many staffing hours, how many nursing hours, and that rate framework then calculates what the daily rate is, should be based on what those hours are. This proposal, along with that documentation requirements, establishes billing rules that if that actual staffing doesn't reflect what the rate is based on, then the rate would be adjusted accordingly. We would have a 90% threshold, so when actual staffing is less than 90% of that planned staffing that the rate is based on, the provider's billing rate would be reduced by the difference. For example, if actual staffing is at 85% of planned, the provider rate would be reduced 5%. Again, currently rates are set based on hours entered into that rate framework, but there's no system mechanism to ensure that those rates align with the person's needs. So whereas the previous component of the proposal is looking at actual services rendered, this is looking at making sure that the rates align with the person's needs. This proposal aligns the CRS rates with a person's acuity by having an hourly staffing limit based on the person's case mix. So the case mix would be identified based on the person's assessment. Similarly, with customized living, rates are based on the anticipated units that the provider will provide to the person. However, there's no mechanism in the system to ensure that those rates align with the person's needs. This proposal would also establish a limit similar to what we do on EW, where there are limits within the customized living rate formula that align to the person's case mix. Lastly, this proposal will expedite the sunset of the disproportionate share program. So the disproportionate share program is a program on the EW program where if a person has low needs and the customized living rate is set based on the low amount, and when they go into that rate formula, they may say 15 minutes of this service plus 15 minutes of that service, and it adds up to a daily rate. With the disproportionate share program, it says, even if the services rendered should cost X, you know, there's a rate floor, so we'll increase the rate to Y. Essentially paying for services not rendered to the person. Right now we have a sunset of that disproportionate share program, but that was extended in last year's bill. This would expedite that sunset, reversing last year's extension to ensure that we have rates that reflect what services are rendered to a person, and that we don't have a system that incentivizes a provider to take on low needs folks and pay them a higher rate than essentially people who have higher needs and need higher supports. The next proposal is on budget in our budget book on page 66. This proposal costs $2.4 million in this biennium and about $4 million in savings in the tails. This proposal is centered around the Integrated Community Support Service. We're really seeking to have multiple strategies here to strengthen the oversight of the service. One part of this is rate reform. So right now we have a daily rate for the service, and that we've encountered challenges in that in terms of when a person doesn't actually receive the level of service that the daily rate is based on. This proposal would align rates with service delivery by establishing a 15-minute unit instead of a daily unit, and it would incorporate billing limits based on the person's acuity. Another challenge that we've found is having kind of blurry lines between what is paid for the person's room and board or housing and what is paid for through the Medicaid rate. And federal requirements require that Medicaid does not pay for room and board. What this proposal does would be to authorize housing support for eligible settings and recipients. That's a state-funded program outside of Medicaid, and it would codify the federal requirements that prohibit the use of Medicaid funds for room and board costs. We have seen over time that sometimes providers have had challenges accessing housing support in the service, so we're seeking to really mitigate those challenges by ensuring that they do have access to that other lane of funding, and that the Medicaid funds are not being utilized for housing. This proposal also requires electronic visit verification, adds requirements for service authorization, such as documenting the person's need and prior authorization requirements in instances of high-cost service packages. It also codifies our licensing and setting moratoriums. The next proposal is centered around integrity and quality in nursing home rates. This is found on page 86. This is about $15 million in savings in this biennium and $57 million in the tails. This proposal makes a few different changes. First, we're looking to remove add-ons that essentially pay for costs twice within our rates. The first one is the Plan Closure Rate Adjustment Program. So this was established in 2001 prior to VBR, and the intention was to incentivize closing beds. So this add-on would pay for the cost to the provider of having an empty bed in their facility. Well, since VBR, we're also paying for those empty beds through VBR because value-based reimbursement is paying for the costs that the provider incurs. Providers still have costs for those beds, such as they're still cleaning those rooms and having the facility costs and whatnot. But with both the PCRA program and VBR, we're essentially paying for those costs twice. So this proposal would remove that add-on and just pay for those costs within the traditional VBR system. Similarly, the Performance-Based Incentive Program, or PIP, was also established prior to VBR. This one was established in 2006. And the intention was to pay for projects to improve quality and efficiency, which is a good thing. But since VBR has been implemented, those costs also are paid for within the VBR rate structure. And so this proposal would eliminate the add-on and pay for those costs within the traditional VBR. We're also looking to place maximum limits on the reimbursement for health insurance costs. So since VBR was implemented, health insurance costs within the VBR system have gone up by 69%. Some facilities with self-funded health insurance plans were reimbursed for $30,000 per worker. And this is much higher, triple the state contribution for the state health insurance program. What we're looking to do is just have a high limit for the health insurance costs being reimbursed within the VBR structure. And then lastly, we're looking to modify the current quality limit formula. This quality limit formula was a key component in the VBR rate methodology when it was first passed into law. Value-based reimbursement, the term value, it was seeking to, A, provide rates that actually pay providers for the costs they incur, but also to pay for value. And so we have the cost part of the formula and the value part of the formula, which is the quality limit. Well, the quality limit was set at such a low threshold that almost all facilities meet that. And so there really is nothing in the formula for most facilities that incentivizes quality performance. This proposal would adjust that limit to ensure that if we're increasing costs for nursing homes, that those costs go to increased value for people that we're serving. The next proposal is centered around market and receipt-based services in the disability and older adults space. This is on page 83 and has a fiscal impact of $504,000 in this biennium in savings and $4.5 in the tails. Market, currently we have no explicit limit on the administrative fees when a provider or a lead agency approved vendor charges administrative fees for arranging or delivering a market rate or receipt-based service. So a market rate service is a service that where the rate is established between the provider and the lead agency, and there is no set methodology in state law or in our waiver plans. Receipt-based services are where we're paying for the actual receipts or costs of the service. But we currently pay these administrative fees, but there's no cap to them. And so what this just does is it limits the administrative fees at 6%. We also want to really dive into these services and look into ways where we can have standardized rate methodologies in instances where that makes sense. Sometimes there's a reason why we have a market rate or receipt-based service because maybe there's large variability in the service that is hard to have a standardized methodology. But there may be some instances where these services should have a standardized rate methodology that sufficiently pays for the cost to the provider of incurring the service but isn't doesn't exceed those costs. So what we're looking to do is look at 24-hour emergency assistance, assistive technology, caregiving living expenses, chore services, crisis respite, environmental accessibility adaptations, family training and counseling, respite specialists, specialized equipment and supplies, transitional services, waiver transportation, and homemaking. And come back to the legislature with recommendations on how we can standardize those rates. Some other program integrity proposals include implementation of the uniform services and standards. So mental health uniform service standards would transition some mental health services from certification to licensure. So this includes CTSSS, ARMS, crisis response services, and CCBHCs. We also have a proposal around housing stabilization services termination and redesign. This would align state statute with the termination of this program. It would also require us to develop recommendations for a redesigned benefit with robust program integrity and service quality requirements and come back to the legislature by September 15th, 2027. We also have a proposal on expediting the effective date for improving supportive housing options. So last session, the legislature passed a proposal around recovery residences. This required a certification and a phase down of freestanding room and board. This proposal would make that effective date earlier and would enable us to phase down freestanding room and board quicker, and we would phase up for these services housing support instead, which has much more robust contractual requirements of the provider. This proposal, the next proposal would increase fines and licensure safety. So we haven't increased fines in instances where there are health and safety violations that we're finding, or background studies requirements, where they fail background studies requirements or other licensing violations for quite a long time. So this proposal would increase those fines from $200 to $500 for health, safety, supervision, and background study requirements, and for all other violations from $100 to $300. It would also enable us to have fines and other enforcement mechanisms in instances where, when we go out and we're doing licensure activities and we receive threatening or abusive behavior towards DHS staff, that would enable us to have enforcement mechanisms in those instances. Okay, moving on to critical investments. The first item is on page 54. This is about $330,000 in this biennium and $8.6 million in the TALES. This proposal would add a new MA benefit to assist people who are experiencing early episodes of psychosis so they can access person-centered and evidence-based care to support their needs. Coordinated Specialty Care, or CSC, is the standard of care for treatment for people who experience first episode psychosis. It's evidence-based and team-based, where there would be shared decision-making among many specialists, the person receiving services, and the family. Currently, we have several services in the existing Medicaid program, but they're billed as separate services. We also have grant funds that support payment of services for the FEP model. What we're looking to do here is to have a more comprehensive benefit and pull down a federal match for this service, which is the standard of treatment for people experiencing psychosis. The next proposal is centered around people who are exiting jails and prisons. So in 2024, the legislature authorized and funded a new 1115 benefit for people in exiting jails and prisons to assist them in receiving Medicaid earlier, you know, within the transition period and after they're released. This proposal is the next phase of that. One item within this is to create a case management benefit that is required of us as we are working with CMS for the approval of the 1115 waiver. It would allow us to comply with federal law related to juveniles. So it would provide screening and targeted case management services for juveniles in carceral settings for 30 days prior to release and at least 30 days post-release. A few other investment proposals centered around federal compliance. One, the Medicaid access rule. So in May 2024, CMS published this Medicaid access rule with the goal of increasing access to care, quality and health outcomes, program integrity, and better addressing health equity issues within the Medicaid program. This proposal is just the administrative resources that the state needs for some initial items that we have to implement in the initial years of this rule. Those improvements will increase transparency and accountability. It would enable us to standardize data and monitoring. And one key component is to really enhance states' active beneficiary engagement. So making sure that we have a robust plan and are working with people receiving Medicaid in terms of how we design our programs. The next proposal is also federal compliance. So this would remove the requirement or authority for FBI checks for household members connected to adult day services and adult foster care. This is a requirement from the federal government. I would say these folks will also maintain other background studies requirements. So we would still be doing background studies, but they would all be the other resources that we utilize, such as the Minnesota State court records. Okay, the next section of proposals are our savings proposals. Again, we have these in our budget just because the state is currently also still looking at a structural deficit in the TALES. One of the concerns on waiting for a budget year on adjusting spending on that is if we wait until next year, then we're in the current biennium, essentially, when we're implementing savings items. And in our space, that means immediate rate reductions or immediate initiatives that we would have to implement right away. Versus if we have, you know, a longer period of time, we would be able to adjust in the implementation on a longer runway. So we have, I think, around six proposals in this space. The first one is sustaining disability services access through efficiency measures. Many of these were within the governor's budget last year. The first one limits billing for residential services to 351 days. This would align with the absence factor that we currently have within the rates that already increases the rates to a level of around 14 to 15 days within the year of absences. This would align the billing limits with what that absence factor pays for. This proposal also modifies the absence and utilization factor for day services. Day services has a higher absence factor than what any of our data analysis has suggested, and it's higher than, say, the residential services absence factor. So this would put it back down to the level that what the data recommends. This proposal also reverses the rate tier increases for family residential services that was put into law last year, and it would restrict the residential overnight factor in community residential services. So this would default to the asleep factor for people unless there's an exception that the person needs. The next proposal modifies the county share within the Behavioral Health Fund. Right now, the counties have 22.95% share. This would increase that to 50%. The next proposal reinstates parental fees for families who have income over 675% of the federal poverty guidelines. For context, that's around $223,000 for a family of four. The next proposal reduces disability grants or eliminates disability grants. We have, I think, four grants in this space. The first one is innovation grants. These are grants that began in 2016, and the goal was to incentivize innovative ideas. With the budget deficit, we are prioritizing, you know, Medicaid funding that we get a federal match on, and so we are proposing to eliminate this grant. The next item is the MnChoices Modifications Grant. This MnChoices is funded to the counties through the Medicaid program as well, and so we are proposing to eliminate that grant. The next item is a pre-admission screening grant. This funds costs to counties that they incur for the pre-admission screenings to nursing homes. It doesn't fully fund their costs, and we have another proposal later in the presentation that I'll give that we're seeking to really minimize workload in this space. The next one is eliminating the day training and habilitation grant. This grant was eliminated one time last session, but the base funding was left for DHS. So this would eliminate the base funding. And then lastly, this proposal would eliminate the long-term services and supports loan program, which the department has challenges in administering since you know, I like to joke, we are not a bank. We don't have the mechanisms to operate as a loan program within DHS. And we need to make sure that if we have a loan program that we have sufficient expertise and program integrity provisions in to make sure that those dollars are paid back and that we have the requirements within the program. So we are seeking to eliminate that program and shift spending in other needed ways. The next proposal modifies the nursing home facility level of care eligibility for CADI and BI. So nursing facility level of care is the criteria that establishes eligibility for CADI and BI waivers. Currently, under current law, a person must demonstrate one of the following. Either they have to have a high need for assistance in four or more activities of daily living, or they need to have assistance for one of the critical ADLs, such as toileting, positioning, or transferring, or they need to have a requirement for daily clinical monitoring, or they need to have significant difficulty or with cognition or behavior, or they need to live alone and other risk factors are present. So those are all ORs under current law. And what this proposal does is it seeks to kind of tighten those requirements by eliminating the criteria for the daily clinical monitoring or the live alone and other risk factors present. Our proposal would impact around 1.75% of spending, so not very many recipients would be impacted by this change. And we would anticipate that even if they're not eligible under the nursing facility level of care in this instance, they would be eligible for, say, our state plan services such as CFSS. And I think this is the last one on this category. The next one limits inflationary adjustments in DWRS and value-based reimbursement. This proposal would limit the inflationary adjustments to 2% per year. I would also note in the numbers there, there are interactive impacts with all of the other proposals in the governor's budget package as well. And I'll do a time check, Chair Knorr.
We're almost there, okay. So please proceed.
Okay, budget neutral, just breeze through these. This is a budget neutral proposal around MnChoice's efficiencies. So we're really looking to further help the lead agencies, counties and tribes in the assessment process. The first part is eliminating the requirement for them to conduct an in-person assessment for certain people seeking nursing home admission. We're also looking to eliminate the unnecessary step in the assessment process for people who are seeking services in the community, the OBRA 1 screening. And then lastly, removing an access barrier for people who are temporarily in an institution and seeking to return to the community on their previous waiver by making those instances having the assessment valid for 365 days. So they don't need to go and get a new assessment if they had a valid assessment within that time period. We also have a proposal around targeted case management. This has been a long time coming. This would bring Minnesota's targeted case management, or TCM, services into federal compliance. We've been working with counties on this. And so this would enable us to establish a new cost-based rate methodology and reconciliation process that would be allowable under the federal guidelines. It's budget neutral. The next one is would allow us to access medical records without paying a fee. Right now, SMRT, of course, is the team that establishes MA eligibility for people with disabilities, and we're just looking to have any way we can ease the process and quicken the timelines for people waiting for the SMRTs. And then lastly, we have a technical page that incorporate some changes around where funding is appropriated, ensuring that the grants and the administrative funding align with our accounting structure. We have some technical language corrections from last year's bill. Some instances where we're seeking carry forward for instances where we think that grant dollars won't finish in time for this fiscal year, and specifying direct payments for tribal and county governments. That's a carry forward from last year's bill where we're just cleaning some language up. Lastly, you can find our budget book on our website on the link in the presentation. And with that, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you so much, Director Bailey. We do have individuals who signed up to testify on this. So we'll start with Ms. Fairchild. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
My name is Linda Fairchild. Thank you, Chair Knorr, Chair Schumacher, and Human Services Committee for allowing me to talk. For the record, my name is Linda Fairchild, and I'm a family residential service provider in Wright County. I operate for significant medical and severe behavioral needs. I've done this for 37 years, and these people have lived with me for 20 plus years. This is a job I love, but currently feel the Department of Human Services is working to make family residential services homes close. We are made to feel unwelcome, unneeded, and that we should be paid less related to choosing to care for the vulnerable adults we love in our homes. When did caring for persons in our homes as a family mean that we should be treated like this, be reimbursed less than even minimum wage? I'm here to testify today about the governor's budget recommendations, and specifically for moving the bill for only paying us for 351 days, reducing FRS payments 25% to the original flat tier rate, and limiting inflationary increases. I'm concerned that homes will only be paid 351 days versus 365 days, as the current DWRS framework has a built-in leave days of 14 days for out-of-home needs for a CRS home and 6 days of out-of-home needs coverage for a family residential setting. It is my understanding that DHS created this methodology because individuals are gone for hospitalizations, visits with families, and on vacation. And instead of having to recreate a new service agreement, this was a built-in coverage and made the system easier for all parties. Again, DHS created this. But to now only pay a waiver home for 351 days or any care provider less than what we actually provide is not appropriate. Is this not fraud for saying that we are caring for people and that they are actually in our house, but we're not going to get paid for it? If DHS or the governor wants the system for DWRS to reflect the true needs, why is DHS not modifying the system they designed to reflect the true picture? The governor also proposed in this segment to reverse back the rate tier increases for family residential services and life sharing services. Family residential service providers are already taking a significant pay reduction as DHS recommended that family residential services move to the flat rate and CMS approved this as of 4/1/26. For my home, this is a 53% pay cut. And now in the governor's proposal, you want to cut me another 25%? How am I then to care for those in my home and pay my bills? The hourly rate on this current flat rate range is between $8.12 an hour to $15.97 per hour. But all other waiver providers are reimbursed for their staff $20.50 an hour. The governor's budget proposal would reduce the hourly wage for a family home further to only $6.40 an hour, up to $12.69 an hour. Again, the rest of the waiver providers will get reimbursed to pay their staff $20.50 an hour. This is not fair. This is not okay. Out of the flat rate paid to family residential service providers, we have other expenses. It's just not staffing. We incur expenses for transportation, program needs, staffing benefits. And this was built into the DWRS framework DHS created, but now the flat tiers only pay homes for staffing costs. So where will my other costs come from? This again looks like DHS is wanting CRS residential homes to close. This is sad. Why is our workforce and waiver being limited to only 2% increase? This is the other issue. When we have such a staffing shortage, we are now not going to be able to pay our staff an increase and limit it only to 2%. How will that keep staff working in our homes? What other health service group in Minnesota is kept to this low inflationary rate? I don't know. I fear that if you move any of these forward, the cost to the most vulnerable is critical and catastrophic. Family residential services homes will close and are closing. The cost savings is not there and will have a significant cost increase because of this. It doesn't matter whether a person lives in a home with their family, an apartment, a family residential home, or CRS, a corporate residential home. They're all part of the system. They all need to exist because they meet everybody's needs. Isn't that what we fight for? To be person-centered? If you change this dramatically, our homes won't be able to stay open. I will have to give up the people I love because I can't pay my bills and it's not fair. Please do not move these parts of the governor's budget bill forward. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person I have on the list is Mr. Berry. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Hello, thank you. Thank you, Chair and members. My name is Douglas Berry, and I serve as a treatment director with Touchstone Mental Health, providing intensive residential treatment services, otherwise known as IRTS. I am here in strong opposition to the proposed changes to IRTS service limits and authorization requirements. IRTS already operates with significant clinical oversight. Before admission, individuals undergo multiple levels of care assessments to ensure this is the appropriate setting. Once admitted, there are weekly required clinical reviews led by licensed mental health professionals specifically to assess ongoing needs and medical necessity. In addition, existing licensing reviews are in place to evaluate whether services remain appropriate. In other words, the oversight this proposal seeks to create already exists. What this change will do is add administrative burden, more paperwork, more authorization processes, and more opportunities for delays in care. That is time taken away from direct treatment for individuals with serious mental illness. Clinically, a 30-day limit does not reflect the reality of the population we serve. Individuals entering IRTS today are increasingly acute, often stepping down from inpatient hospitalization. Stabilization, skill building, and safe discharge planning take time, especially considering long-standing mental health symptoms and behavioral patterns. 30 days is simply not sufficient. The likely outcome is not increased accountability nor reduced utilization. It is premature discharge, destabilization, higher rates of rehospitalization. That creates greater strain on hospitals, providers, and the broader system while undermining recovery for the individuals we serve. The current 90-day framework already ensures accountability while allowing the clinical flexibility necessary to meet complex needs. I urge you to reject this proposal and instead partner with providers on solutions that meet the intended outcomes without compromising care. Thank you for your time and happy to take any questions.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Do we have anyone in the public who wants to testify? Mr. Burke. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Josh Berg, and I'm the Director of Minnesota Services and Strategic Growth at Accessible Space, Inc. Every day, my colleagues and I work to ensure Minnesotans with disabilities can wake up in their own homes, safe, supported, and a part of their communities, not hidden, not warehoused, home. I'm here because many of the proposals coming out of DHS and the Gov's office are not just flawed, they are dangerously disconnected from the realities of the people who will feel them. These ideas are being shaped far from bedrooms, kitchens, and living rooms where real life happens, and that distance matters. Many of the administration leaders advancing these changes have never spent meaningful time inside the residential settings they're trying to redesign. They haven't stood in a doorway at 2 a.m. watching a staff member help someone transfer safely. They haven't been there when a ventilator alarm goes off, when muscle spasticity spikes, or when cognition suddenly shifts. We have invited them repeatedly to see this work up close, And when they've come outside of stage tours on their own time, they've all said the same thing. They didn't realize. They realized they had been making decisions in a vacuum, and that vacuum is dangerous. Residential disability services are not appointments or tasks. They are continuous, human, minute-to-minute responses to changing medical, physical, and cognitive needs. When policy treats this work like it can be chopped into units, capped by the hour, or proven by an app, it fundamentally misunderstands the lived reality, and people pay the price. Because when community-based services destabilize, people don't need less support, they lose their homes. Expanding EVV into residential services might sound reasonable on paper, but in real life, it pulls staff away from hands-on care and replaces presence with paperwork. In a 24-hour home, that erosion of attention creates risk. Risk to safety, stability, and housing. Forcing integrated community supports into 15-minute billing units is even more alarming. ICS exists so people with complex disabilities can live ordinary lives, not lives broken into transactions. Unit-based billing forces staff to think about the clock instead of the person. And the caps on the proposed caps on services across the board are most dangerous of all. People with paralysis, traumatic brain injuries, or degenerative conditions do not suddenly need less help because a billing limit is reached. What actually happens is this. A person has a bad day. Equipment fails, fatigue worsens, cognition declines, transfers become unsafe. Under these proposals, the provider cannot adapt to meet the needs of those they serve. The choice becomes unsafe care or unpaid care. Eventually, something preventable happens. The result is hospitalization or institutional placement, not because the person can't live in the community, but because policy removed the flexibility that made community living possible. That is institutionalization by policy. Eliminating remote supports pushes even harder in that same direction. Remote supports are not shortcuts. For many people, they are the reason independence is possible at all. Removing them forces higher staffing models everywhere and makes community living feel and function more like an institution. DHS and the Gov's office may not intend to push people into institutions, but under Olmstead, intent does not matter. Effect does. And the effect of these proposals is clear. Community options become unstable and institutional placement becomes the default. Mr. Chair and members, this is where your role matters. Oversight is not a formality. It is a moral responsibility. You are the safeguard when executive agencies lose touch with realities on the ground. I am asking you to step in, not for providers, but for the Minnesotans with disabilities who do not get a second chance when policies fail them. Please do not allow well-intentioned but disconnected ideas to undo decades of progress towards community integration. Once people are pushed out of their homes and into institutions, it is very, very hard to bring them back. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. I am Nathaniel M. Olson. I'm the disability advocate for the state of Minnesota. And again, we heard the Department of Human Services talk about how more money, more budget is going to help people. But when we have over 600,000 people with disabilities in the state of Minnesota, and one thing that I'm going to make perfectly clear, I have looked at a place that I'm part of and literally was sadly assaulted and was called the R word. And we have the Department of Human Services saying that we're going to figure out stuff. This place has 52 violations and has not been shut down. One person was actually pushed by a staff member. So the idea of the Department of Human Services sitting here thinking that they are going to help while we have people literally being taken advantage of in the state of Minnesota is ridiculous. The Department of Human Services is doing nothing to help us at all. I've talked to thousands of people about this issue. But sadly, if we do not solve this issue, these disability people are going to go homeless. The Department of Human Services needs to step up. And I need you guys to step up to put a stop to this and hold them accountable. I cannot sit here and watch these people suffer anymore. I can do all I can do to testify, but it's your job to hold the government, Governor Walz, responsible. It's your job to make sure that these people are safe. So let's work together and let's put a stop to the Department of Human Services making excuses, and let's put a stop to this fraud. Let's put a stop to these people being taken advantage of. Because I will do everything to bring this all up to the federal government and testify on behalf of the disabilities for the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Do we have anyone else in the public? Seeing none, we now move to member discussion. Representative Ganda.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think most of these will be for Director Bailey. First of all, it's tempting to oppose this thing on its face because it comes from the governor, but there is some good stuff in here, so I won't go that far. So first of all, I think it kind of all wraps around to some of the other testifiers. The question I had is, so how much of this governor's proposal comes from the governor? How much comes from the governor's immediate staff? How much comes from the department? Okay, how much of it rolls up into this? Again, the governor himself, the governor's immediate staff, or the department? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Director Bailey.
Chair and our Representative Gander, that's an interesting question. I would say the governor's budget development process is really iterative. As soon as we end session, we are into planning and preparing for the next year. So we are hard at work all interim. And the way our process works is we actually do a call out. I send an email and have spreadsheets of people to fill out throughout the agency. What are all your ideas? When we do that, we lay out what we're seeking to achieve in terms of the pillars. You know, we knew over the summer we needed program integrity proposals, for example. We knew over the summer we needed, you know, federal compliance proposals. But largely, we're asking for any ideas. And then we have a process where we're vetting those ideas. Are they ready? Are they robust enough? Would they be prioritized in a policy year, for example? What have we heard about this issue in the past at the legislature? You know, most of our work is on a continuum. And so that's our process internally. And we don't submit our ideas until around October to the governor. Throughout that process, the governor's office staffs, we do a lot of meetings with them, though, and there are ideas that we're adding. You know, if there's issues that pop up, we're adding proposals throughout that time. Once we submit it to the governor, then there's adjustments. There's, have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? And throughout the time period, it's really iterative. So it's kind of hard to say where, you know, what ideas came from the governor himself and what ideas came from staff. It's more collaborative. There certainly are some that, you know, the governor is like, I want to see something that achieves X, and we then work on it, how to get there. Whereas others, it's more collaborative. So not necessarily answering your question, but it's similar to how you do work here in terms of you got a lot of voices and you're trying to get to the best solution.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My next question pertains to the elimination of MCOs. I am a big believer in the MCO construct. I do think that it provides a lot of cost containment, and it also helps emphasize preventive services. So the idea of eliminating MCOs inside of our Medicaid and some of our other state programs, I don't like that. I like that later on you came to maybe creating some better guardrails for MCOs, right, doubling down on some of their pre-authorization review steps that they would have to do similarly to what we're doing inside. So I guess that was just maybe more of a statement. I love that we're doing this. This does deserve a good bit of dissection, you know, bit by bit. There's good. I loved a lot of the program integrity stuff. Now then, finally, the last question I will have then pertains to shifting some of the financial eligibility functions from the counties to the state. Of course, that'll bring some cost, and I'm just curious, To do that, would you have people in each county, or would you try to manage that from a central location in the state? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Director Bill.
Chair and/or Representative Gander, I think it really depends on the functions and what the way that we developed the proposal is we thought about, given the functions that are moving, what are the tasks and requirements of the state and how many FTEs do we need? We haven't gotten to the point of kind of developing what the project plan would be and where those folks would be located throughout the state. It may be instances where it may make sense to have folks regionally located versus, in St. Paul. So we aren't that far down the road on establishing what it really looks like, to be frank. But it is a consideration in terms of where the workforce is, and you know, we'll definitely be wanting to work with our counties and tribes in terms of making it successful. If it means that having a regional approach would make it more successful, then you know, we would be open to that. If having a centralized one building in St. Paul, we would be open to that. We have locations throughout the state currently, and we process, for example, Minnesota Care eligibility currently. So it isn't that everyone is centrally located in St. Paul under the status quo, but we haven't made those decisions yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One final thing, and it's really to applaud the fact that you're going to roll back a post-pandemic remote function. And anything you can find, hopefully some of those things automatically did sunset, some of the post-COVID things we did. But by all means, just go through your programs and take a look and say, is there anything else that we did for COVID that we don't really have to continue on? And I know there are good staff people probably in charge of those programs, but maybe by attrition they could be put into some of other programs. So I love that you're willing to do that, and anything we can do to wind those things down and kind of get back would be a good thing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you so much. This is a lot to digest here. So I just want to go into my first question is, why did we not get the bill language? Like, why did we not get the bill in the packet with us today? That would be very helpful. That's my first question.
Director Bill.
Chair and/or Representative Gilman, I agree. And we are frustrated we don't have the bill language. We are working really hard with the reviser on trying to get the bill complete and have it released. We just were hitting timeline issues. So, that's all I could say. It's, we wish that we had the bill language in front of you.
Vice Gilman.
All right, thank you so much. I've got just a few questions here. Again, it's tough when we've only got 20 minutes to have these discussions over such, I hope we'll be.
Well, once we have the bill language, I think we'll have more deep dive.
Okay, well, this question I have, thank you, Chair, for that assurance that we'll be able to come back to the question. Thanks, Mark. So which of these proposals today that were presented to us came from the Optum report? Was anything taken from the Optum report? Again, taxpayers spent $2.5 million on this report that us in this committee room have never seen. But I want to know, since this has been getting worked on since we got out of the legislature last year, did you take into account the suggestions of the Optum report to bring some of these proposals to us?
Director Bailey, and I have five more members on the list.
Chair Nor, Representative Gilman, I can get back to you on like a comprehensive list. I would say a lot of the billing, having billing limits, having electronic visit verification, those items we had been working on, frankly, before we got the Optum report, but do align with some of the items in the Optum report. I could take a deeper look in terms of if some align, if there's more that align. I would say the Optum report we got very late in the process, where we already were kind of completing the governor's budget and it was already out, not out to the public, but the process for releasing the governor's budget is long and winding and exhausting. And the timing of getting the Optum report and to be able to have effective
proposal drafting. It's one thing to get an idea from a report like that. It's a whole other thing to put it into what should be the legislative strategy. You know, how do we cost it out in the timeline that we had? I think the Optum report came out in February 1st or something like that, and we already were, like, tying up the governor's budget. But I would say there are some things that we already were working on that were aligned with some items in the report.
Vice Chair Gilman.
All right. Thank you for that information. So on page 11, I'm just going to go into really quick the case management piece of this. So there's a study that's going to be provided with recommendations and given to the legislature, it looks like in 2029. And then there's a bullet point that says phase out contracted case management by July 1st, 2031. So what I keep seeing in so many different committees, and it's just, I think it's probably one of the most frustrating parts of this job, is we have these reports, and thank you, Director Bailey, for just giving us information. The wheels keep moving, things keep spinning, and we keep asking for working groups and reports and all these different things to happen, but the timing of them always seems to be off, and then we don't necessarily go back to what was the intent of this working group, what was the intent of this report, and then those things don't get to be built into this bill that the governor's bringing forward to us. So the phase out, we're just going to wipe out an entire group of people that are doing case management. But we don't even know, is the study going to support that or not? It's like we're saying, this is our goal, but we don't even know if the study would support that or not, is what I'm seeing. And how will this work around the state? I'm talking rural Minnesota. It's been great. Rep Fisher and I'm so grateful. We're going to carry some of these buckets together, and we might not agree to this, you know, but I believe we always put an end date on something, and now it looks like things are coming back in, and now they're getting taken out, and it's supposed to be the legislature that gets to read these reports, understand what the, you know, what the working group's done and why it's necessary. So again, I want to know why is the goal phase out without even knowing if that is going to be best for Minnesotans, because there's so many people that need to have case managers.
Director Bill, I think we had a bill from Jeff Fisher, which mm-hmm. we'll have more discussion on.
Chair Norr, Representative Gilman, I think why we're doing the phase out initially is because we do know that Minnesotans largely are experiencing variable access to case management as a result of expanded use of contracted case management. And so we see this as really a pivotal item that we need to do to ensure that this critical service, probably the most critical service on the waivers, that people have access to trained professionals with the same rules and responsibilities, that they know who their waiver case manager is, that waiver case manager works directly for the entity responsible, the county or the tribe, and that work actually occurs appropriately so that they have an effective support plan. That waiver case manager is so critical in establishing the PERSA's supports. I mean, they are the go-between between that person and the services they need. And what we've heard for years is the use of contracted case management has resulted in people having, not even knowing sometimes who their case manager is, and they're having a lack of accountability. So we see that as very separate from the report, actually. The report won't be looking into whether we should contract it out again or not. The report will be looking into, okay, of the local entity that's doing this work, what are the clearest roles and responsibilities we need to have in state law so that everyone's on the same page, and how do we pay them effectively? Because one big piece that is probably why contracted case management has occurred for so long is that we haven't updated the rates. So a huge piece of that report is really looking into how to fully fund our local governments for doing this really critical service. So that's, we see them as separate. We know that contracted case management, we know from talking to people, that it has resulted in disparate access to care.
We have other folks.
I know. We'll come back. So much. I can't wait. And again, I just want to thank the testifier from Wright County, Linda Fairchild, for her testimony. And I also got, you know, we're getting lots of emails and from people that are doing the work. Thank you for taking time out of your day to do this, and thank you for serving folks that really need you. So I appreciate it.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you for this proposal. I do want to acknowledge that this is a huge lift. This is a massive lift. It takes a ton of time, and people have worked really, really hard to do it. And there are pieces of this that I think are really good movements towards creating a system in the state of Minnesota that is equal regardless of which 87 counties you live in. Because right now, because of the way that we operate in the state, we put a ton on our counties, and not all counties have the same resources, same experience, same expertise. And so there's a lot of really good stuff in here that I think will create regional equity, and I'm excited about that. So I want to start by saying thank you for that. I also think there are some common sense things in here that I'm like really glad that we're looking at. I'm also very pleased at the MCO piece. Managed care organizations have been this black hole of thing that we can't get any information about as a legislature. We don't know what they're doing for fraud prevention. The contracts are proprietary. We don't have a lot of details. And it seems like double the bureaucrats, right? Double the people to authorize, double the people to approve, double the bureaucrats, right? We have state bureaucrats, and then we have these MCO bureaucrats. So I'm really excited to see some of that. I will say, however, I am not supportive in any way, shape, or form of any proposals that cut funding to people with disabilities again. I think everybody in this committee knows how I felt last year. I was very loud. I was very obnoxious. I think everybody was really annoyed with me by the time we all went home, and that's okay. I was really annoyed with the budget last year and how we balanced it on the backs of people with disabilities. So I am not supportive of any of that in any form, full stop. And so I want to be really clear that we cut $1 billion from people with disabilities last year. It is not a budget year. We do not have to do that again. We do not have to do anything to hurt them more. It is a policy year. And so I am vehemently opposed to any of those cuts this year. We are not in a position where we need to look down some magic looking glass 6 years from now and hurt people today because of what might happen.
We have extra 5 minutes, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Bailey, I just have a couple questions. Whose idea was it to move from the MCOs to an ACO program? Is it from the governor, or is that an agency kind of directive?
Director Bailey.
Chair Noor, Representative Murphy, it was a collaborative effort between DHS and the governor's office.
Representative Murphy.
Does, Director Bailey, does Canada use MCOs?
Director Bailey.
Chair Noor, Representative Murphy, I am not knowledgeable of Canada's healthcare system.
Mr. Chair, the answer is no. They don't use MCOs. They have a government-controlled healthcare. This is what's going on here. This is where we're moving. And so when we look at, you know, kind of the job we've done here, having our centralized, and now we want more of it. You know, we're looking at, you know, more control. We want more control. We want more employees. We want more dollars. And we want to cut the needy the services to disabled and elders. That's not making sense. That's not why we need to go centralized. That's why we need to decentralize. But what this is about, to move from MCOs to ASOs, is centralized government healthcare. That's what it's about. And that's been a goal ever since I've been here. People have talked about it. That's what this is. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to piggyback off of the comments of Representative Hicks and Representative Murphy. I, too, cannot support a budget that balances the budget on the back of the disabled or even nursing homes. I think it's disgusting. We come in here each and every year, and it's like cut, 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 and our most vulnerable are hurt. And those are the individuals that don't have the fancy high-paid lobbyists to advocate for them. And by time, it's, I think it's time that all of us on our committee put our feet down and say, absolutely no way are we going to support this anymore. You know, for me, this pretty much says we're balancing the budget on the backs of the disabled because we can't control the fraud in Department of Human Services. People will be homeless or they will be cost shifted to nursing homes. That does not save the state any dollars. I talked to a provider, a family residential service provider this weekend, messaged her. On one client, it's $700 a day that they are losing and $10.50 an hour. That's it. She's like, my doors are going to close. And she's got three or four residences in that home. And she loves those kids, those individuals, as they're part of the family. I mean, every provider, it's part of their family. And this is like a huge wage theft, if you ask me. We're supposedly against wage theft. Think about if you went to your employer, and your employer had said, you're making this much money, but now we are going to cut it up to 85%. Would you stay there? Probably not. And I bet if employers in the state of Minnesota were doing that, Attorney General Keith Ellison would be filing lawsuits against the big business. But there's no big business to file lawsuits for these people. And how do you guys sleep at night? I really want to know, how do you sleep at night knowing that you are using the disabled to balance your budget?
I'll give to Vice Chair Keel and then closing remarks from, all right.
Thank you, Chair. One clarification and then just one statement. On slide 16, on the obtaining enrolling address information, can you walk me through how somebody who's unsheltered or doesn't necessarily have a home address would fill out this information? And then I guess my secondary question to that is, if they don't have an address, does that mean that with these changes they're not eligible for any medical assistance? And then I have one other question.
Director Bale.
Chair Nor, Representative Keeler, I believe this part of HR 1 just is a requirement for states to make sure that we do our due diligence on pulling in external data sources on updates to addresses. So it doesn't have any impact in terms of the end user or enrollee. It's more, states, you can't just keep that address in your system for the year or 6 months that they're eligible for the program without paying these external sources such as UPS or USPS and getting updated address information. We did see during the unwinding, addresses actually were a huge hindrance of, you know, getting a hold of people. So this may be one area where it would be a benefit to have updated address information. But no, they wouldn't drop because of it.
Thank you. That's good to know. Just want to keep an eye on that because that would be horrific. The other thing I guess I just want to say is I absolutely do not want to applaud you for the elimination of remote support. I have seen CCRI. I've gone out. I've spent a lot of time actually visiting the homes that utilize these technology supports. It's making sure that people can move towards some independence. Like, not every individual who lives with a disability needs to have people around them all the time, 100% of the time. Having these tools in their home is actually super cool, and I think it helps us give them a tool that helps them feel independent, empowered. It does help our staff shortage. I'm really disappointed that this was one of the areas that we're looking to eliminate. We can talk a little bit more offline about the components of it, because I know it's probably way more robust, and without seeing the bill language in front of us, it's kind of hard to know. But I just want that on the record. I think what CCRI does in our community, in our region, is amazing, and eliminating that would just be catastrophic for them. So I want that on the record, and happy to work towards a better solution at the end of this. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much. With that, members, we have the budget book online. We don't have any further agenda items. We're now adjourned.